Some neighbourhoods in Britain are very tough to live in. Some are so-called left-behind areas. Social mobility and social capital are low. And so is the level of health. Now, a range of policies over the years have tried to help, but have they worked? And what's best to do next? With me to discuss all this, I'm delighted to welcome Baroness Hilary Armstrong, who is chair of something called the Independent Commission on Neighbourhoods. And she's a former cabinet minister in the new Labour government who had responsibility for neighbourhood renewal. And Andrew O'Brien, who's also part of the ICON Commission and has a long history working in government on neighbourhoods and social capital. Welcome both. This concept of neighbourhood, why for you is it the most important thing? And what is it about neighbourhoods? Is it place? Is it the communities in them? Is it both? Can you just unpack the concept for us?
Well, what we're looking at is what's happening to people where they live. Some people don't have connections with people in a wide range that some of us take for granted. For some people, that's not the way their lives are lived for all sorts of reasons. And very often, what you find in our country is that people will be confined to one neighborhood because that's where they were born and brought up, and they just have never had the opportunity to really think they can be part of anywhere else. And we know that there are areas in the country, fairly small, but a lot of them, where people are more likely to be on benefit, more likely to have long-term ill health, less likely to have qualifications that would have enabled them to get into work. And that means that those areas end up not giving people the opportunities that they need in order to live a life that many people take for granted these days.
Conditions got worse in these neighbourhoods?
I think that we've been aware of them for a long time, but I think that we've not had the right level of intervention. So the last government did talk a lot about levelling up, but they saw that as largely being in terms of infrastructure, trains, bridges, roads, etc. And actually, what we know is you've got to base it around people and around the concerns that they have and work with them so that they feel that they do have some agency, some involvement in decisions that are going on. And that then enables them to really begin to take on a whole range of other things.
We just released a report called Progress and Pressure, looking at how these neighbours have changed. And essentially the story is, and obviously Hilary and colleagues in Labour government at the time can take some credit for this, is that during the 2000s, we did see progress in a lot of these disadvantaged places. But then in 2010, post-austerity financial crisis, we saw a lot of that progress roll back. And again, these places are now what we call mission-critical neighbourhoods, these areas where the governments across health, education, opportunity, etc., where we think those neighbours are most challenged. We see them back in a state where they are under a significant amount of pressure. And I think the reason why this commission is so timely, I think, and why it sort of seems to capture some imagination, is that we're making government learn and think differently about how it does its work. So one of the things we found in our commission's work is how little data government is actually collecting about these neighbourhoods. It's quite difficult to piece together sometimes exactly what's happened. In broad terms, we can know what's happened in terms of employment, say, or health, but actually getting the granular understanding of why people in this estate or in this electoral ward or this council area, why exactly are things not quite working, it's a difficult picture to put together. And I think that's where neighbourhood lens is so helpful, because it's making government and policymakers think about things not in the abstract sense. You know, we talk about health outcomes or education outcomes or economic outcomes, but actually think about organic, real places and communities, and things are quite messy in those areas. It's not as straightforward as simply saying we're going to drop a program in here. It's really understanding the lay of the land, the assets and the challenges which local people have in those areas, and adapting policy to think, how is this going to work in Blackpool and Carlisle and Clacton, these different parts of the country where government often talks about them? But I think what we're finding in our work and the research we're doing is we still don't know as much as we should do. And we should know a lot more about them. And we could do a lot more to help them if we really did take a neighbourhood level approach and try to understand.
These are areas that are coastal communities, but also communities where they used to be involved in heavy industry, mining, shipyards, steel making, and they've lost the main industry, and the right work wasn't done at that time to make sure that there was a real future that people could identify with, could feel was about them. And that is where you've had a real fall over, in a sense, of the cultural and economic life in those neighbourhoods. And we've not found the right way forward.
So you point there to deindustrialisation, Hilary, and Andrew, you pointed to then austerity following the crash. But are there other long-term social trends that you think are particularly pertinent in some of these areas? If you think about Angus Deaton and Anne Case's book, Deaths of Despair, they also talk about the decline of religion. They talk about the decline of certain stability of families. They talk about the decline of unions, a kind of way of life. I don't know whether that's come up in your work.
Well, I would say that deindustrialization contributed to all of those things that you just mentioned. You know, there were some disadvantages in the old way of life. Certainly if you were a woman, you were there to service the men so that they were fit enough to do their shift work. It was the women who spent all of their time, other than looking after the men and their children, keeping the community going. So they were the people who were really active in the church as well as in other community organizations. And even today, we know that the main volunteers are women in local community groups. Women have not lost that desire to actually come together to make life better for their family and their community.
I agree with Hilary. I think economic dislocation has been key to this, because often that underpinned what we talk a lot about, which is the social infrastructure of places. And I think the loss of those. But there are some cultural trends as well. You know, we have become a bit more individualistic as a society, less open to joining in collective group activity. We find it harder to find the time and the space and the kind of continue those commitments because life has become so much more kind of hectic and more piecemeal. But definitely, if you look at our data, those places which have fallen first behind on those kind of key metrics of health and the economy and so on, often the key determinant factor, along with transportation and the lack of physical connection to other places, is that social infrastructure. And again, there's a very strong link between health and social capital and social infrastructure. There, I think there was a study done in the United States looking at kind of major review, looking at social capital and its links to physical health, and found very strong positive relationship across, I think it was 124 different studies, that showed that social capital has a very, very strong impact on people's physical health outcomes. But the same could be true for work. Same could be true for education. So, you know, rather than taking a passive approach, which I think policymakers have done for a long time, and assuming that, oh, well, you know, if we fix public services, or maybe even if we fix local economies, that this social infrastructure will emerge, I actually think what we're encouraging government to think about is the other way around almost, which is actually, how do you create some of that social infrastructure? And then that's the thing that attracts the businesses and makes it easy to reform public service and deliver change. And if you can rebuild that social fabric in a place, then you can actually generate some transformational change.
One of the things that certainly affects young people is that family life is now very different, and they spend much more time either on their phone or they're on their tablet or their laptop. They spend a lot more time on their own, but they also get exposed to views and ideas that my mum, she did just not believe that children and young people could ever be exposed to that sort of thing. So, of course, there are differences. There are huge differences across our society. But in neighbourhoods like this, it's almost like every difference is exaggerated and has become a really entrenched problem. And it's therefore, how do we shift that? We also know that people who don't have those individual problems in their family, they too will benefit from more place-based health provision, because that will help us get further into prevention of the acute problems. And that's the only way we're going to solve the problem of our public services being overwhelmed by those of us who are getting older and those of us who've got long-term conditions.
Going back to the Independent Commission on Neighbourhoods, which you're both part of, you've identified some of the areas that you want to focus on, and you've called them mission critical. And I think there's over 613. So can you just say how you identified those?
We worked back from, the government has, we've got mission-driven government, it has these five missions, and we tried to essentially create a kind of composite index that would look at metrics across each of those five missions. And rather than being over-dominated, say, by one area like health or the economy, tried to look at crime and economic opportunity and social mobility and other issues and energy, which are also part of the overall fabric, as you were, of outcomes and what it feels like in those places. So we've taken a slightly kind of a broader approach to looking at the challenges, and then frankly having to work with what we've got, which, as I mentioned at the beginning, data at the local, at a hyper-local level, this neighborhood level, isn't always prevalent, but there are quite a number of proxies that you can use and data that is collected. And I think I'm right in saying we had over 120 different metrics we were able to use and utilize across those five mission areas. That gave us a sense of challenge, and why these 613 were picked is because they were the furthest behind in achieving those government missions. In terms of the social fabric, that's a sort of, we're building on work that Local Trust and other organizations have done in the past to look at levels of volunteering and participation in civic life, like kind of political voting patterns, looking at people's sense of well-being and community life and the vibrancy of it, and looking at assets as well. And again, in the United States, we have had him visit over Daniel Aldrich. I had done some really interesting work looking at social infrastructure. So these are the institutions of places, the sports clubs, the charities, the mum and toddler groups, things like that. His work has shown actually there's a very strong correlation between that and levels of social capital. So essentially, and it sounds obvious when you say it, but if you don't have those institutions on the ground, you're going to have low levels of social capital. So by mapping those assets, we can actually make a direct translation across to the levels of kind of community spirit and social connection in those places. It's not complete overlap. There are some areas in the 613 which do have quite strong levels of social capital, but they just got big need. But around 70% of the mission critical neighbors, 70% of those are what we would call doubly disadvantaged. So not only poor outcomes, but very low levels of social infrastructure as well. So I think that's helped to guide us in thinking this social infrastructure, social capital point is critical to improving outcomes in those places.
And you've got 613 areas, just short of 1 million residents in those areas across the country. And the neighbourhood level, the sort of population size is about 1,500, that sort of size?
Exactly.
So you've got the index and you've got the map. And as Hilary says, there's a concentration in the northwest, northeast, Yorks and Humber, coastal towns, some in the southwest, some in Kent. And I know you've been out every Friday to visit some of these areas. And I wondered if you both could just give us a flavour of what it's been like.
What I have seen is those areas where there has been a level of intervention, which means local people really have taken hold of things. And they don't wait for the council or the government to sort their problems out. And they actually come together and work in ways where they're able to know that they're going to have enough income to make sure that they can continue with a youth club, with the summer play schemes, regular sessions in the community centre with older people where they can come together for a meal and that sort of thing. And we've seen that even with austerity and the huge cutback in local government spending on things like this, that because the local authority have seen a local area really trying to do things differently, the local authority in a couple of areas we've been to had put a community chef in who was both training the volunteers around how to cook sustainable, healthy meals, but also bringing people together for meals And even in one place, when the schools were on holiday and there was a holiday play scheme, they send the kids home at night with a meal so that the family can share a meal together. And that was the creative way of not having a lot of money, but actually making sure that you make a contribution which brings people together and gives them a sense that they can be involved in a very positive way. And where people think that, then the outcomes are becoming much better. We still have a problem in some areas of post-industrial decline where people have not had the culture, because quite honestly, if they'd been entrepreneurial in their activities, they'd have not done very well if they worked in the pit or whatever. And so they constantly see the answer as being somebody's going to provide it, rather than we can get together, work out what we actually can do and attract support for that. And yes, it'll not all be easy and done overnight, but we will find a way forward. And I still think that that is why those cultural issues are so important in any neighborhood.
Everyone always talks about these places and how we're targeting funds and programs, or we're doing social prescribing, or we're doing this neighborhood health intervention, or whatever it happens to be. But what when you go to visit these places and you ask them, you know, have you spoken to your GP surgery recently? No, they then come talk to us. What about the police? Do they come around here? Oh, not really, no. What about your counselors? Sometimes the council is quite active, sometimes it isn't. But it's a really mixed picture. And given that we know so many challenges are clustered in these neighborhoods, what you hear here in Whitehall or in Westminster about, oh, these are absolute priority areas, there does seem to be this disconnect between what we think we're doing here and the impact we think we're having. And I think that's partly because of the cuts to public services and the capacity constraints in local governments and in public services. But I think it's also cultural, where we've forgotten the importance of building those relationships and that constant sense of understanding and listening to people in those areas. And we've got a job to do, I think, to get the, not just public sector, the private sector and other institutions to see the value of engaging these quick places. And as Hilary says, when you go there, obviously we had slightly one-sided look at it, in the sense of obviously we're going to those places where we've seen some positive impacts in many cases. We're trying to find out what's the secret sauce and magic ingredient that we can take out elsewhere. But as Hilary says, there's a huge amount of enthusiasm for people in those neighbors to make a change. I don't think it's because neighborhoods are hostile to working with other actors, but maybe we're not making as much effort as we think we are in actually trying to work with them.
Some of my work in the Northeast, you know, there's a lot of efforts, but quite fragmented and unconnected, I would say. Philanthropic, council, totally voluntary, and people spending a lot of time trying to get different small pockets of change from organizations and having to go through incredible requirements for showing the impact, the benefit for the cost, which is quite difficult. The outcomes are very important but can't be measured so easily. What could make it easier for people to access assets in those areas from disparate sources, so people don't have to spend half their time filling in administrative forms?
It does come up a lot. And I think there are a few different things. One, the lack of coordination. The worst thing in some ways is everyone trying to help these places at the same time, and it becomes a bit kind of disjointed. Where things seem to work well is having a trusted anchor institutional organization that can bring this together and kind of mediate and have conversations on behalf of that neighborhood, and obviously be community-led and resident-led, but have the ability to and capacity to engage with all the various actors that want to work in that area. And we need to support those institutions. And, you know, maybe back in the day, you know, your trade unions, your churches, or some kind of local institution would do this naturally. But in some places, those institutions disappeared, but we can't do without them. So we have to try and find a way to fund them and support them. I think the other element is absolutely much more trust. What come out really strong from this work is the act of being together and working together that makes the change. But I think in government, we're so instrumentalizing about it. We're sort of like, oh, if you want to solve a health problem, you have to run a health program. Well, as Hilary just explained, sometimes it's food, sometimes it's the creative arts, sometimes it's sport, sometimes it's something completely random. And trusting local people to do their work. And again, that's one of the programs we've looked at quite a lot, the Big Local, what it did really brilliantly was it gave residents the power to say, here's £1 million. You decide what you do with it. Obviously, it's got to be improving the neighborhood, but be creative. And they've had positive impact. And I think government and the foundation sector and philanthropy needs to be much more flexible in the way that it approaches working with these areas. And the last bit I would say is just, you know, having the patience and the long-termism. And I mean, it's something you did, Hilary, with New Deal for Community. It's not a year thing, is it?
It's got to be a long-term program. The whole thing about coordination, it just needs people at a local level to feel they can bring services together. It has been depressing to hear from them that the GP practice are not interested. We can never get an appointment, let alone anything else. And it's depressing to hear that other institutions expect them to travel in order to get any response. Mm. And that children were not doing well at school because, for all sorts of reasons, they're not getting the level of support that they need. That's very discouraging. But actually, there are ways of pulling things together and making sure people work together. And we've been talking as well to some of the foundations who give money, and we're getting them to try to work together so that if there are two or three of them giving support to a local neighborhood, they're not being asked to give two or three different forms of accountability. If they go spend all their time saying how they're spending the money, they don't end up getting on and making sure they do that.
You mentioned previous policies, because this is not a new issue. We've had attempts before, the New Deal for Communities, 39 areas, wasn't it, across the country. And then there's Big Local, which was 150, with £1 million given to each. And then we've just had, last October, the Plan for Neighbourhoods, which is government first foray into this arena, although neighbourhoods being quite large towns, I think, they were focusing on. Hilary, how do we do this well in the past? And given we're now in a new era, how do we avoid some of the pitfalls that you spotted when you were in government?
When I was local government housing and then regeneration minister, was that I was able to work very closely with the social exclusion unit, which was a unit that the Prime Minister had set up to work across government. And that meant that right from the beginning, we were looking at the problems people thought were intractable. And we were looking at what is it that you need to do to actually turn that round. And their first report really was on how local government worked. And right across the board, we were talking about developing partnerships, ways of working at a local level that actually involved anchor institutions that were more than the local authority, and that also involved local business as well as the charitable sector. Coming out of that, we established a national strategy for neighbourhood renewal, and that was a sort of sub-department within environment, transport and the regions, and it was out of that we developed New Deal for Communities. We very clearly learned very early on that if you try to do it all through the local authority, it's not going to work. And that was when local authorities had much wider remits and hadn't been constrained by budget cuts to largely doing social care for adults and for children and not much else. This government are going to have to come to do much more cross-cutting spending reviews and looking at spending in a different way. We knew that in individual departments, you wouldn't get money for something unless you could demonstrate that you were going to be working with another department that was working in the same place or on the same issue or whatever.
So, Andrew, could you just summarise the green paper that the Independent Commission on Neighbourhoods, ICON, has just put out with some interesting recommendations?
In the green paper, we set out four buckets, really, of intentions. I think one is obviously building what Hilary just said about the cross-cutting nature of this issue. How do we get Whitehall, the centre, to think about these neighbours, these places? How do you get them to work collaboratively together to design funding and programmes and data collection and evidence so that we understand what's going on there? That's critically important. Another area is around local government and devolution. Obviously, there had been devolution under New Labour, but it's kind of much more kind of regionalised approach, particularly looking with these elected mayors and combined authorities. Obviously, that's a been more developed over the past few years, and how do we make sure of that, and local councils and local government has a role to collaborate with neighbours and places to improve their outcomes. Then we're also looking at sustainability of funding, and coming back to what Hilary was saying earlier about the long-termism, you know, what can we learn from initiatives like some of the endowments that foundations have, some of the formula changes which government has done in the past. How can we make sure that there is a sustainable level of money? And it's not always huge amounts of money. I mean, again, one of the surprising things when you visit these places, just how much a small amount of money creatively used have such a big impact. And finally, the last area is around what we call area-based initiatives. So these are programs like Clinidial for Communities and a new wave of those programs. And we're excited to see what this new phase of Plan for Neighbourhoods could look like. The Chancellor said there'll be, well, overall 350 places. And they seem to have taken on board some of the recommendations we've made around much smaller targeting of a community. So Jennifer, you made a good point. You know, we don't think a town is a neighbourhood. You know, we need to be thinking a lot more smaller scale than that. And I think they're starting to do that. And a lot more focus on the community and the residential and the resident-led approach. How do you build that capability? And that was a key part of our green paper. Sometimes one of the challenges you have in this work is people are quite, not defeatist, but it's very, oh, well, what can be done? And there's, you know, all there is money, essentially. It's just about distributing money. And money is really important. What I think green paper just shows is that there are hundreds of things we could be doing, really, actually, to improve these areas. And obviously, we need to consolidate and pick a few, but there's no shortage of good thinking that we could deploy to help these neighbourhoods.
And that's what comes across really well in the green paper that you produced. The really good ideas in that, that kind of seem, many of which seem so obvious, but actually there's been so much policy churn and no consistency, it seems, for a while. And you have got a fair wind at the moment, it seems, with this. You mentioned the spending review, the 350 communities pledge support, but also the trailblazer neighbourhoods as well, 500 million for those, 17 of them in mission critical areas, and also the 240 million capital for economic regeneration in neighbourhoods too, still much to be defined. But on the other hand, you've also got, with the neighbourhood plan, quite large areas, the sort of definition of a neighbourhood. You've got neighbourhood policing, which presumably also has got another footprint, and then neighbourhood health centres, which has another idea of a footprint. Do you think it's going to be possible to pull these things together, or is it okay just to run with different footprints?
You don't have to work from the same footprint, but you have to work with a knowledge and understanding of what else is going on so that you can be part of the linking up. And that is what some public services have never thought they should be doing. But actually, the message for the future is just know enough about what's going on as a separate organization, develop a good relationship with these other organizations so that signposting of people, giving people the confidence to work with another group where they need to, actually happens.
You've both made points that you really do need stable policy over a period of, what, 10, 20 years to really make progress here. And I was reading a book the other day by Paul Collier called Left Behind, where he talks about it's taken a while for the downward spiral. There needs to take time to have the upward spiral back out of the conditions that some of these areas are in. Isn't there a responsibility on all of us at the moment to try to develop a narrative and the evidence that this is just not negotiable now? This has to be a way forwards, and chart what a stable policy path would look like.
Government focuses far too much on policies and programs, not enough on institutions. And actually, the way you can focus on things over a long period of time is building the right institutions within places and those actors. And that can create some stability over time. And trusting and building relations between local people and institutions is critical. And I completely agree. Coming back to, you know, the evidence we've seen, if you can build up the local social infrastructure and those institutions at the local level, you can have a really positive transformational change. I mean, one of our commissioners, Andrew Wright, in Broadstone and Leicestershire, she's sort of done a huge amount of work. And what she's built is an institution, a locally led, resident-led institution, which is working across health and the economy and all sorts of different areas. I think the solution is backing more things like that and ensuring that every neighbourhood in the country has access to these kinds of institutions, rather than worrying about, okay, we've got a five-year parliament, what's this programme going to look like, how much are we going to spend on this and that. A much more organic approach to thinking what the basic commitment the state should be thinking about is No area should be deprived of that kind of social fabric and those social institutions. Institutional structure, that is something I think you can build for the longer term. And it can be flexible. It means you can work with something that's different at different times and changes and adapts to the areas that help it. And I think that's what we failed to do, particularly, I think, in the 80s and then again under the post-austerity period, is we let too many of these institutions just die. We didn't bother to replace them or help them. And that, I think, is one of the big lessons.
I do think that that is the way to go. I don't underestimate how difficult that is. I didn't think anybody would be daft enough to get rid of SureStart because people really got so much out of it right across the board. I still think it was the daftest decision of the coalition, but there you go. I said earlier that those neighbourhoods who've worked out how they can be sustainable by getting something from which they make an income as a local community organisation. And for Angie and Leicester, they built the health centre. They got money. They both used some of the money from New Deal for Communities that was capital, and they got money from other people. And they, I think the local authority gifted them the land, which was an important contribution, but they then built the health centre and they have the GP as the anchor institution in the health centre and other health-related organisations in the health centre, but that brings them an income every year. With another, a motorway was built at the edge of the city and they got permission to have a stake in the service station. They get 1% of the turnover and that keeps them going. You know, another one, it's that they've got a solar farm and a wind turbine and they get income from that. They are making sure that whatever happens at government level, local people have got the sense of we're in this for the long term.
So we must leave it there. Many thanks to Hilary Armstrong and Andrew O'Brien for their thoughtful insights. What I heard from today's discussion is that there are some very challenged neighbourhoods around the country. It's possible to pinpoint these and to understand a lot more about them, particularly as we've got some more data than we ever had to map. The problems there are multifaceted, long-term, and they need a long-term rebuild over many years and with many different approaches. And that it's not just about building libraries and roads and other things like that, but also social capital, that is the relationships between communities and the confidence of these communities to try and solve some of the issues themselves. And also that the current government does have a set of policies which is very conducive to all of this. And hopefully ICON, the Independent Commission on Neighbourhoods, which Andrew and Hilary are part of, will be able to shape government policies going forwards and the investment that's already been set out. Next month, we'll be turning our attention back to the NHS and the long-awaited 10-year plan. And meantime, thanks as ever to Sean and Leo at the Health Foundation, to Pelly and team at Malt Productions. And until next time, it's goodbye from me, Jennifer Dixon.